Morning, everybody. Good to see you on this beautiful Memorial Day weekend. About time. It's about time. So, one of the oldest sutras is the Satipatthana Sutra. And it's translated from Pali. And interesting thing when you look at the Satipatthana Sutra is that it seems to be describing Zazen. And this is interesting because that's 2,300 years ago. It's, 800 years before the Zen school starts. And it seems to be describing what we do here. Come in, you guys. There, you can sit back there or you can come all the way in here. Sati means staying focused on the object of meditation without floating away. And the comment is from Shakyamuni Buddha, supposedly, not floating away like a hollow pumpkin that bobs up and down in the water. So a lot of our meditation is bobbing up and down like a hollow pumpkin. And so we bring the hollow pumpkin back. We bring it back. So that's sati. And then we have patana. Patana translates as close, firm, and steadfast. And the analogy that's described by supposedly the historical Buddha, although we don't know it, is like floor planks. When our meditation is firm and steadfast, there's no gap between the floor planks. No gap. There are no overwhelming emotions and incessant thinking leaking through. The floor is solid, like this one. And a second way in which patana is talked about is rubbing two sticks together to make fire. So when you rub two sticks together to make fire, if you stop rubbing, come on in, you guys. You can come in here. There's room in here. If you stop rubbing, no fire, even for a second. So you, each moment you have to start rubbing over and over again, over and over again. Ever notice this in your zazen? Each time our focus falters, and it always falters, we simply come back. So that's Satipatthana, or zazen, right? And our goal is to be in the Satipatthana, be face to face with the object of our meditation. Be face to face. So if it's my breathing that I'm focusing on, I'm with my breathing. I keep bringing myself back to my breathing. I notice the sensations in my belly. I'm face to face with the tension in my belly or wherever it is. I notice the contraction. I don't try to get rid of the contraction. I'm just face to face with it, just noticing it. So that's good Zen stuff. And I guess it's not surprising that they're the same because it's the same tradition. And a key component of this way of talking about what happens in meditation in our lives is that when there are gaps between the floor planks and the yucky stuff comes through, it tends to pollute the whole floor. So these are referred to in Buddhism, and some of you know this better than I, as the three poisons, the three pollutants that come up through the floorboard. Delusion, greedy desire, and anger. Although there are lots of different ways of defining them, but that's what I'm doing for today. Delusion, greedy desire, and anger. So when we're face to face with what's going on in our psyche as we do zazen, these poisons come up. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes they come up. They come up. And, of course, these poisons perpetuate the gap between the floorboards. They perpetuate the gap between who we think we are and our true interconnected self. This huge floor that is the universe. It's all connected. Even though there are gaps in the floorboards, those are wonderful. There are no gaps because they give some air to the floor. Right? But we don't realize this. We practice. And, of course, those poisons in traditional Buddhism, they continuously weave veils of greedy desire, veils of delusion, veils of anger. And so in our Zen practice, our goal is to just be with this stuff, with kindness, with attention. Even with sleepiness is okay. Okay, if we can just bring ourselves back. Okay. Come on in. There's plenty of room. Gee. Okay, well, we'll sit for a while. So, so there's a fish in Japan that's considered very, used to be, I don't know. I didn't Google it, so I don't know anymore. But Suzuki Roshi used to talk about a fish called the globe fish, which is a delicacy. Well, I don't know if they still eat it. Do you?
I haven't heard that they've stopped.
Oh, okay. And the globe fish is a delicacy. But it has some poison in it. It has some poison in it. And you, so if you, part of the joy of eating it is imbibing the poison. Imbibing the poison. Not having too much poison. Not getting consumed by the poison. Just a little bit of poison. So in our meditation, there's always a little bit of poison coming in. Doesn't matter how many decades or kalpas you've been sitting, a little bit of poison is coming through the floorboards. And that poison creates a veil. It creates a separation between us and the floor and each other and our deepest selves. So I want to talk a little bit about those three types of veils called varana. Varana is veil. Three primary types of klesha varanas, poisonous veils. Delusional veils. So delusional veils can be divided into bodily veils, heart veils, and mind veils. So bodily veils. And this is stuff that we aren't so aware of in our daily lives because we're distracted and we're rushing around and we're trying to get something done and we're trying to balance things. But in our meditation, we can become more aware of these. We shouldn't look for them. It's just that they're somebody labeled, some teacher labeled years ago, stuff that comes up. It keeps us not feeling joined to each other, not feeling part of this big, alive universe, but feeling like somehow we're not okay. When we are, we're always okay, because it's our beating heart is its beating heart. We're always okay. So delusional veils, the bodily veils, we contract in our body, especially when we're sitting. If you're sitting on in a retreat, you'll experience contraction. Why do we contract? Well, I don't know, many different reasons. For one is the posture seems a little bit stiff. We don't get to move. Another is that sometimes emotional memories come up, and they're stored in our body. We're not even aware of them, but they're stored in our body. And we can have aches in our body, which is a sort of is that opening up to those. Especially if our minds are still and focused, we can be more aware of the pain in our body and the often the underlying anguish. Sometimes there's no anguish, but sometimes there is underlying anguish. Suzuki Roshi, my teacher, said, "The only thing to do about pain is let it be painful." That's the only thing to do about pain. The only thing to do about painful emotion is to let it be painful. But when we watch with kind attention, simply feeling our aches and pains, the old hurts come up and they work their way out. They work their way out. In their own time, not in our time. In their own time. So I've talked before about bodily veils that I've had. When I was young, one of my bodily veils was that I shook when I sat in meditation. I don't know if there was any emotion. There was a lot of shaking. I never discovered if there was emotion, but it was kind of disheartening and embarrassing. And a second type of veil that we have is resistance to just being still, the urge to move. People say, "Oh, well, maybe I can do a half-day retreat. I don't think I'm ready for a full-day retreat. I don't think I could sit still for that long." I understand that. I remember that. We feel itchy when we sit for long times. We feel tingly. We feel hungry. We feel sleepy. We feel achy. We feel nauseated. A lot of people in retreat, longer retreats, get nauseated. Boy, isn't that an advertisement for retreats, you guys? Here I am wanting more people to do retreats. Because I actually believe that if you want to transform yourself, retreats are essential. Daily sitting is good, but retreats are essential. Because it's only with retreats do you really get in touch with these poisons, see these veils. And of course, these veils are made of gossamer. There's nothing there, but they feel heavy. They feel like they're made of iron, steel. They're just gossamer veils. Of course, there are lots of them, but they're just gossamer. So years ago when I came down for my first retreat here in Minnesota, when Katagiri Roshi came out, I didn't know anybody here. Came down from northern Minnesota, and it was probably a three-day retreat or a four-day retreat. And I sat next to a guy who sat for the whole time in perfect full lotus. And he never moved. He never moved. And that made me more agitated. That made me more like, woo, woo, woo. So I saw that veil. seeing the veils, seeing them, is the path toward true calmness, which is always here. Always here. Then we can eat the goldfish, the whole goldfish, not just trying to parse out the poison. The whole thing. So that's the first kind of veil, delusional veil. Second kind of veil, heart veils. Heart veils. Well, our heart is covered with veils a lot of the time. We keep our heart shut down a lot of the time to protect ourselves. There's a scary world out there. You know, it's fine. We need to do that. We need to protect ourselves. But in Zazen, we're learning to see the veils and let go of them so we can really open our heart and discover that our heart is exactly the same as this big heart, this huge heart, exactly the same, this tiny little one. Anger, grief, sadness, loneliness, lots of different types of veils. And sometimes in sitting, especially in retreats, we feel discouraged, but actually in daily sitting too. Oh, God, where did that come from? I was just getting calm. Look at that. Look. Maybe I should sit for only 7 minutes. Or maybe I should sit 3 times instead of only once. You know, strategies. Strategies. We're always trying to be strategic. Unfortunately, strategies are important in most of life. But in Zen, throw out the strategies. Really, this is not about strategy. Not about strategy. Because if we're strategic, we're not coming close to something. We're trying to manipulate it, trying to change it, trying to make it be different. But nothing. We need to make it be different. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Internally, I'm talking about. In the world, yes, but internally, I'm talking about. So that's why one of my fondest quotes is the Sandokai, in the darkness there is light. Because when we just feel that those veils surrounding us, that grief, that deep grief, someone who's recently been died or someone who's deeply ill, we can just be with that and see that it's just a veil and let it open up. Let it open up. Anger, sadness, loneliness. And they do protect us. They do protect us. But we need to learn that we can let go of them. We can let go of them. We don't need to continually be protecting our heart. Our heart can protect itself. Protect itself pretty well. Pretty well. And so, if we're sitting with bare awareness, kind bare awareness, a moment of anger will come up, a veil of anger, and it will remind us of something else we feel angry about that we did or someone else did. But then if we just see it and we don't tell a story about it, what happens? Falls away. It just falls away. And then another veil comes up. So that's why we say, in darkness there is light, but don't take it as light. Oh, I've got it. I'm veilless. Watch out. You think you're veilless? Be careful of veilless human beings, because this is our life. This is our life. This idea we have of perfection, it's just our idea. Just our idea. And the third type of delusional veil are mind veils. Mind veils. Well, you know that. In Zazen, you know that. Mental chattering, worrying, habitual thought patterns, constant planning, manipulating, regretting, rehearsing, regretting, rehearsing, regretting, rehearsing. Right. Right? Oh, boy. So that comes up in our city. And you may think, oh, I'm not very advanced yet. When I get more advanced, that won't come up. Well, where are you going to advance to? Where are you going to advance to? It's just your idea. Just your idea. So I was sitting next to this guy in this first retreat here in Minneapolis many years ago, who didn't move the whole time. And his name, some of you know, was Cal Appleby. And I had never met him. And Cal is ill right now, so all my love to Cal. I had never met him, but my mind veils were really gone as I was sitting next to that guy. Anger, self-pity, jeez, how long has that guy been sitting? What happened to me? Why couldn't I do it? I could barely do half lotus, and only for 3 minutes at best. Oh, mama. Anger, how? And then wondering, how did he do that? Is he a yogi or something? Suzuki Roshi never taught me how to really do yoga. I should have done yoga all these years. You know, so there I am sitting next to him. He's perfectly still, and his stillness is causing me to be agitated. It's true. And if it hasn't happened to you, it will. If we start telling stories, blaming ourselves or others, thinking, what if I had only done yoga instead of done all that stupid Japanese stuff that Suzuki had me doing? Then I could sit like him. What if? And then a story about, who knows, it can go in any direction, right? And there I am sitting with my supposedly zazen, being still. Everybody, when I sit here, you know, during sesshin, we're all still. But I have sense about how still this room really is. You know? I'm not too psychic, but I'm a little bit psychic. I can sense what's going on in all this stillness. It's a trip. But this is part of our practice. Just to be with it. Just to be with it. With kindness. With kindness. With no judgment. No story. Well, a story comes up. Well, then we just honor the story, but we notice it's a story, okay? We don't spend 13 minutes doing it before we realize it's a story. We realize it's a story right away. Oh, let the story tell itself if it wants to. You know, no problem. No problem, right? No problem. So suffering is not caused by emotional pain. It's caused by our avoidance of it. Or you could say our indulgence in it. Our avoidance of it or our indulgence in it. And I'm really fond of this quote by Helen Keller. Remember Helen Keller? Deaf and blind? Life is either a daring adventure or nothing. This is a daring adventure to do this zazen. It may seem boring to you or tedious, but if you really get into it, it's a daring adventure. It's a daring adventure to see all these veils, just to breathe with them and watch them. Watch the spell they cast over us, and then watch them fall away. It's a daring adventure to do that moment after moment, day after day. Our commitment to see through these veils and to eat the goldfish. It's daring. And we can discover, when we do this, what Katagiri Roshi always used to talk about. At the pivot of nothingness, the next moment unfolds and a new world appears. But to know, to return to the pivot of nothingness, we have to let these fails be where they are and allow them to fall away in their own time. Because if we try to make them fall away in our own time, we're just creating more veils, right? So the second type of veil that I want to talk about is greedy desire. Greedy desire. So there's desire and there's greed, and then there's greedy desire. So greedy desire casts a spell on us. We become trapped in a cycle of repetitive thoughts and emotions, regardless of what it is. I've told a story before about adolescent love. Most of you have been adolescents at some time. Many of you are still adolescents inside, or you just don't let it out there. So what happens? We go into, when we fall in love, we go into a semi-conscious, dreamy la-la land, right? Semi-conscious, dreamy la-la land. I have even known people sitting in meditation, believe it or not, to go into dreamy, semi-conscious la-la lands. Have you ever known anybody in meditation? Surprise! Surprise! When we do that, we're not seeing the object at all. We're not seeing the person at all. We're not seeing the floorboards at all. We're only seeing our own desire. That's all we're seeing, right? So my first girlfriend, Mickey, I drove around the neighborhood just to drive by her house. I drove around in the morning. I drove around after school. I drove around at night, right? Just to see her house. Wow. Not bad. But the problem is that we spend so much of our lives doing this, caught by greedy desire. And so we lose our feeling of connectedness with each other, just as we are, with ourselves, just as we are. Not as we want to be, but just as we are. And of course, in meditation in particular, sometimes there's just an endless parade of desires. An endless parade. But those are veils, the veil of desire. We just see those veils. We can give a little gosho to them if we want to. And just let them be. And realize at some point that they're just gossamer. And of course, we use desire also to cover up other stuff, don't we? Greedy desire to cover up all kinds of worries, all kinds of difficulties, all kinds of inadequacies. And we do this over and over and over. So, on the cushion is a chance. This is a laboratory. This is our laboratory. Our body is a laboratory. Our body and the wall. And other people supporting us is a laboratory. Just do this. Just do this practice. And we can learn to, we will learn. You do learn in meditation, although it's not cognitive, to just let these desires come in, do their dance, do their performance, and then move along. We learn to carry our desires lightly, for the most part. Like monarch butterflies and swallow tail butterflies, painted lady butterflies alighting on us. We don't try to catch them, put them in our butterfly collection. Oh, there they are. They have color. They have motion. Oh, come on in. They're showing us something beautiful. Even our most negative emotions are showing us something beautiful about our struggles, about our worries. And the third type of veil, of course, is anger, although sometimes I say hatred, but hatred is probably a better translation, but I'm using anger. And anger comes up a lot. And we can transform it constructively when it comes up. When we see the veil, we can transform the anger. It gives us a lot of energy to do stuff. If we're not caught by it, if we're not transfixed by it. It's informing us that our mind and our heart are in pain. That's what's informing us. They're in pain. Physical pain reveals something about our body. We know how to listen to it. Emotional pain tells something about our heart. We can listen to it. And most of our anger, and of course I'm generalizing here, but most of our anger is stuff from the past, about stuff from the past. I mean, it's about stuff that you just did to me, but I really only got angry because of stuff from the past. Most of our anger would be just like almost nothing. It would be just like a butterfly that just came and then moved on, but because of stuff from the past. Mostly, it's from what big people did to us when we were little people. We were little people. We were children. We were adolescents. And everybody else was big. And we got angry. They did mean things. They overlooked us. They didn't take care of us. They were rude. So most of our anger is about that stuff. That stuff that's gate, gone, but not gone, because it's in us. So we can just notice that. We can just notice that. And even remind ourselves. So I had a student whom I'll call Tom, and Tom was a regular meditator, and he came from a Roman Catholic family. And he had been an altar boy, and he had anger, a lot of anger that would come up in his retreats, a lot of anger, and after a while he began making the connection between his childhood and his anger. While he was doing his asana. And this is not with therapy, but he just began getting in touch with his earlier emotions about being an altar boy who wasn't good enough and angry at the priest. Now, the priest didn't abuse him, no abuse, but just for being so gruff and acting like, giving him the idea that he was a bad person and angry at that and not wanting to be around the priest. So when we would do traditional retreats, he didn't want to do our traditional retreats. He only wanted to do our contemporary retreats. Does anybody know why? You want to say why? Yeah, yeah, the rituals. That's when he got angry. He never got angry in any of our contemporary retreats. But in our traditional ones, it was like, oh, I got to follow this form or I'm not okay. This is the way I have to do it. And took him like a year before he realized that. A year. But that's okay. A year is fine. A year is fine. You know, it would take as long as it takes. Just be with it. Just be with it. With your kind attention. And if your attention isn't very kind, if you can't make your attention kind, then do some loving kindness meditation until you can come back to your kind attention. Some loving kindness meditation. I mean, say some nice stuff. Lots of loving kindness meditation. So on the second day of a retreat, Tom had been sitting with his anger for the whole 2 days, and then on the second day he was really focusing. He was not letting that pumpkin, every time that pumpkin, hollow pumpkin in the water floated away, he was bringing it back. Every time he noticed a gap in the floorboards, he was focusing. He was focusing. But the anger was the thing for him. But at some point, it just fell away. It just fell away. And Tom fell away, too. The sense of a separate Tom. Because so much of his identity was his anger. That was so much of who he was, his anger. That fell away. And there was nothing but joy and love and connection and connection. So, that was wonderful. Of course, I was happy and he was happy. That was wonderful. And then he came to me with a quote from the Lotus Sutra. He said, look, I just saw this. This is true. We just studied the Lotus Sutra. So I said, yeah, okay. And he said, you, the richest person, he's quoting the Lotus Sutra, you, the richest person in the world, have been laboring and struggling endlessly. He said, that was me. Not understanding that you already possess all that you seek. That's me. So that was his parting of the veil. I'm sure more veils came up later. He's not practicing here anymore, so... But that was his parting of the veils. And he described being with his very good friend after the retreat, and his very good friend who had known what had gone on during the retreat, and known about his awakening, his openness to interconnecting with all life, said to him, well, what's it feel like to be enlightened? Sounds like a naive question, but naive questions are good because those are the true ones, you know. And he said, enlightened? Wanda knows this better than I do. Because she's written all this stuff down. He said, I don't have any sense of being enlightened as I'm walking with you. It's quite wonderful. One leg is following the other. One leg is leading the other. I don't know which is which, and it doesn't matter. So when anger flashes, it can be very deep, very disconcerting. And there can be a moment when we're consumed by rage, or many, many moments when we're consumed by rage. But a trained Zazen mind returns quickly to seeing and identifying the veil. Without trying to push the veil away, because if you actually try to push the veil away, you get all snarled up in it. It snarls you up. But it's just gossamer if you don't mess with it. If you don't mess with it. So my first teacher, I've talked about this quite a bit, Suzuki Roshi, had anger issues as a young man. Had anger issues. By the time I met him, he was not a young man. He was very old. Like 60 or something. Or maybe, I don't know. Something like that. Really old. Remember, did anybody remember, don't trust anybody over 30? So here was a six-year-old guy that I was trusting. I don't know about that. But I was doing it. So there were two types of things that evoked his anger in particular. One was people hurting each other. That evoked his anger. And I was driving once with him to Tassajara Zen Monastery, and there were hunters along the road. With guns. I guess they were hunting. I don't know what you were hunting down there. Somebody knows, quail or something. I don't think anything big. And he whispered to me, we should hunt the hunters. Wow. But I thought, wow, that's strong. That's strong. That's strong. So he had anger. He came up about people hurting other people or other animal people, you know, animal people too, right? Plant people. And I've told this story before about how my friend John Steiner this during the Vietnam War, we're sitting in San Francisco at the Zen Center, and my friend John Steiner keeps asking him in a group discussion about what can we do to stop this war? Well, what should we be doing? Shouldn't we be getting out there more? Shouldn't we be doing this? And finally, he comes back 3 or 4 times. Finally, Suzuki leaps up with a stick and he whaps John. And he says something like, if you can't see through your own mind, how can you ever stop the war? But that also, and I thought, oh, that's a great teaching. But it was also Suzuki Roshi's anger issues that had modulated some over the years. So he was able to use them to help a student. But I don't know how much he helped John. I asked John later. I said, what was that like? He said, oh, it was good. I was puzzled. I didn't see how it could be good. It wouldn't have been good for me. And then later, Suzuki apologized to John. And I actually read this in David Chadwick's book. I didn't know about it. And he commented that he remembered World War II. He remembered. He was right there in the middle of it in Japan. And he had a lot of anger about that war. So this guy, peppering him with questions about the Vietnam War, brought up his issues about war and hurting others, and specifically his memories, his emotional memories from World War II. So that was one thing that he got angry about. Another thing that he got angry about was his absent-mindedness. He was really absent-minded. And he got angry at himself, because a Zen teacher isn't supposed to be absent-minded. You know? But he got angry because he would inconvenience people a lot with his absent-mindedness, and that made him doubly angry. But by the time I knew him, he was able to see all those veils, with the exception of that one time with John Steiner, and just let them go and be very, very light about them. And of course, I didn't see him with his wife, so, you know, I can't tell. I mean, privately, because they lived upstairs, right? But he was very light. He was able to see them. So the time that that I've talked about before, when I couldn't find my glasses, these glasses that I can't see much without, actually, my eyes are getting better now, so I don't need them as much as I did then. That's true. They're getting better, yeah. I couldn't find them, and looked all over, and finally I went to see him, and I said, you haven't seen my glasses, have you? And he looked kind of quizzical. He said, no. Then he went upstairs, and he came back upstairs to his room, where he came back down, and he said, are these your glasses? He said, I thought they were mine. And then he laughed and laughed and laughed. I didn't think it was quite as funny as he did. So this is our practice. This is our practice. Learning how to be with these veils, see through them, let them go, and live with some lightness. Live with some lightness. So that we can eat a whole globefish and don't just have to throw out part. When you throw out part of something, that part is gonna come back. It's gonna come back. Anything you throw out will come back. Because everything's interconnected. How could it not come back in an interconnected universe, in an interconnected psyche? How could it not come back? So that's our practice. That's our practice. And, you know, here in Minneapolis, we have a city center. So in a city center, people say, oh, it's harder than in the country, harder to practice. But, you know, stuff comes up in the country, too. When I lived in the monastery, oh, the trips that people would get on about chocolate and about all kinds of things. I mean, you know, just so it's the mind, you know. It's not, the environment's important, but it's the mind. So anyway, here we are in the city, trying to deal with all this stuff in our city life. Outside the Zendo, in the Zendo, on our cushions at home, in the kitchen, with our friends, with the people who we don't like that well, in traffic jams. But this is what we're trying to do. This is what we're trying to do. And we have a possibility of learning how to let go of these iron curtains, which were not made of iron at all. They're not iron curtains. They ain't. They're only gossamer. They're only gossamer. And the best way to do this is through daily sitting is good, but the best way to do this is through either going and spending time in a monastery or doing retreat practice. We have retreats here every month, half day, 2 days, up to 7 days. It's the best way to do it. Not the only way, but it just this takes time and it takes some concerted effort. And that's why they have Zen monasteries. But we can do it in the city too. If we can do it in the city, it's better, because in the city we can take it into our daily lives. We don't need to retreat from the world. We can be in the world. We can be organizing the union. We can be fighting for justice, but fighting lightly for justice, right? Lightly. We can do that. So that's it for me. What would you guys like to bring up? Let's see, how much time do we have? We've got a little time for one or two questions or comments. Questions, comments?
I have a question.
Sure.
When you talked about the things coming up through the floorboard, and the greedy desire being there, how do you acknowledge the greedy desire without feeling shame of having it in the first place?
Well, sometimes you'll see the greedy desire and then you'll see the shame. And if you can see the shame, that's pretty good, because often under greedy desire there is shame. There are layers of kleshas. There are layers of veils. And so then you can just be with the blank. You can just notice the blank. You can just give your kind attention to the blame. Maybe under the blame there's something else. But after a while, there's only openness. But I don't know how many veils. 2 veils? 230 veils? 2,064 veils? I don't know. Yeah?
Follow up to that. Did you say, or with those two examples, the greed, desire, and shame, it doesn't matter which one you look at first?
Whatever comes up. Whatever comes up. We're not trying to be smart in this. We want to be smart in Zen, but we're not trying to be smart. If we're smart, then we get ahead of ourselves and we're not really with what's going on. So whatever comes up. Whatever comes up. Yeah.
What did confuse me a little bit is the idea of examining these things that come up and setting them aside. And what that means.
What it means to limit these things that come up and set them aside. Well, what does it mean to you?
Well, I guess part of what I see is the Zazen practice is to just notice it and then ignore it. Or
let it be. Notice it and let it be.
Yeah.
Yep. So what? I'm sorry. So what's your question?
The part that I'm confused about is that we talk a lot about examining is the best word I can come up with, but I don't think that it's a cognitive.
No, it's not. When we say examine, we don't mean intellectual examination. We don't mean intellectual examination. So, if you use the term examine, think about examining the tree outside the window. Not thinking about its botanical components, but examining the leaves. I'm just looking at the tree right now, but the structure of the leaves, the wind, the branches, looking. So examining, probably, I don't know, how about just looking? Yeah. Because examine churns stuff up in our minds. But if we really look, we are examining. We're just not trying to get anything out. We're just... Vidya, V-I-D-Y-A, looking, looking, seeing. That's a whole other series of talk, seeing. Yeah.
Examining the vehicle, also like noticing or identifying?
Noticing? Sure. Identifying? Sure. Providing we don't go on a cognitive trip about it. Identifying? Yes. Oh, anger. Huh. Anger. Huh. I'm doing this little ritual here. I get, and I'm angry. Huh. And I notice and I feel some, and Father Coughlin is coming up as I'm doing this. Well, what's Father Coughlin have to do with it? Well, Father Coughlin was the priest whom I was the altar boy for. And so he's coming up as I'm trying to do this Orioki right. Everybody else is doing it right. I'm not doing it right. So I just identify. Oh, Father Coughlin. But I'm not getting into some big conversation with Father Coughlin. You can if you want. You go into therapy for that. Fine, but not with Zazen. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's something you said that sparked this in my head, and then it sort of, I feel like now it might be just a useful thing to bring up, and that is that my favorite part in some, many times of the Heart Sutra is no path, no knowledge, no attainment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That sort of just,
mm-hmm.
that With no attainment, there's no hindrance. And
mm-hmm. That's right.
There's no fear. And yeah. Now just letting go of that need to be on a path to achieve, to attain, to know, and letting go of that is a path to being free of all.
Very good. Yeah. Very good. Mm-hmm. It's the Heart Sutra. Yeah.
I have to say that you said you don't change things that you said. In your internal world, and then externally, it's a different story.
Well, you know, we're always, I mean, in the external world, there are always people who are being hurt, and we want our heart opens to them. We want to help them, and we need to believe that by opening up to them and helping them, we can change things. We can change things. And we can change things in the internal world too, but not through a strategy, just by opening up to what is. So things change internally, but not by trying to change them, by trying to be with what is. And externally, we actually have to try to be with what is too. If I'm really going to help you, I have to really pay attention to what your concerns are, what you're struggling with. What your nuances are when you talk with me. I can't really help you if I don't do that. So really they're the same. Really they're the same. Okay, I think our time's up.